After the conclusion of the Camp David conference, any number of my ministerial friends in Cleveland telephoned me to express their feelings. They were filled with excitement, pleasure. One of them said to me, "Don't you have the feeling that the Middle East has turned the corner?" I suspect that they had called largely to receive my confirmation before they bubbled over to their own congregations the next Sunday. Like most Americans, these were not people who stayed abreast of the intricacies of Middle Eastern developments. They had not read, by and large, the two framework documents with which were signed in the White House, Egypt and Israel and the United States, nor had they read the various supporting letters concerning the West Bank and East Jerusalem, concerning the air bases which will be built in the Negev, which were exchanged between the respective governments. What they knew was what they had seen. And what they had seen, or what they thought they had seen, was what the television screens had brought into their living rooms from the White House that night when the conference concluded. Menachem Begin and Anwar Sadat hugging each other, and the President of the United States smiling benignly as if he were presiding at a family reconciliation. What they had seen, or what they thought they had seen, was a triumph of what they would call a ministry of reconciliation. As one said to me, the president witnessed to our faith. They felt that through courage and wisdom and perseverance, tact, Jimmy Carter had brought together two men who were kept apart by politics and by national interests, and had won them over to see those areas in which they shared common concerns, won them over to respect and friendship each for the other. What they saw, or what they thought they had seen, was a new mood in America, a change of guard, if you will. The warmongers were no longer in the White House, the peacemakers were there. And when Mr. Carter quoted from the Gospel according to Matthew to the Congress the next day, they were excited and thrilled. For they too feel, "Blessed are the peacemakers, for these are the children of God." America had somehow found again her rightful place in the Council of Nations. Vietnam was behind us, a new world, a new role was ahead of us. Now, I confess that I did not have the heart to remind these enthusiasts that the government of Mr. Carter had last November tried to prevent the bilateral meetings between Egypt and Israel. The United States, we who are its citizens, have had precious few opportunities these last years to be innocently happy with the policies and the achievements of our government. I did not think it was the time to deny to others this opportunity to simply rejoice in what America can and should stand for. Perhaps I should have spoken a bit, because I also sensed in their conversation a feeling of which perhaps they were even consciously unawares. And that was that it was somehow inevitable that it would be a Christian who would bring a ministry of reconciliation to the Muslim and to the Jew. I did suggest to some of them that each of their faiths, and these were men of faith, all three of them, sought peace, valued peace, was dedicate to peace, that in meetings such as this, no one puts into the heart of another what is not already there. That each of the men who had come as heads of state to Camp David had witnessed to his faith and to the political interests, the national interests of his own country. I reminded them, or tried to, that despite the wooded surroundings, the rustic lodges, the sport shirts, Camp David was not a denominational retreat, but a closely guarded military enclave. And it was not important to the success of Camp David whether or not the men who occasionally played chess with each other liked each other. What was important to the conclave was whether or not these men could find ways of adjusting their special needs and interests in such a way that they could produce a document, a policy, which would further the interests of all parties to the conference. I would suggest, that what happened at Camp David was not a ministry of reconciliation, however truly significant, and it was significant and critical, the role of the President of the United States in keeping the conversations going may have been. The model, which is the counseling model, which lies behind these words, a ministry of reconciliation, is simply not appropriate. What you had at Camp David was hard-headed men of policy coming together to find if there was not a common denominator which would allow them to adjust policy in their part of the world to their mutual better self-interest. And I frankly find little wrong with that. Indeed, it gives me encouragement for the future. For I know that one can take a group of people and take them out to an institute or retreat on a Sabbath, and one can discuss piety, and they will be very pious at the service that Sabbath, and when they come back to town, week after week in their natural surroundings, they will revert to their usual religious attitudes. Moods are transient. Sometimes we can be picked up for the moment, but essentially we revert to type, to our typical attitudes and to our habitual patterns of action. But when a nation or an individual acts out of what he perceives to be his self-interest, then our actions tend to be consistent. Then there is hope that we will attempt to build on what has been and to see that plans which have been announced, in fact, eventuate and succeed. Simply put, each of the men who had come to Camp David, each of the countries that was represented at Camp David, was there because it was to their interest to be there. There is a direct relationship between the bread riots which occurred in Cairo and Alexandria about a year ago and Mr. Sadat's attendance at Camp David. There's a direct relationship between the firefight between Egyptian and Libyan tanks which occurred about a year ago and Mr. Sadat's attendance at Camp David. There's a direct relationship between Soviet human intervention in sub-Sahara Africa and Mr. Sadat's attendance at Camp David. Simply put, peace has become necessary to him in order to protect himself from enemies without and in order that he can begin to grapple with the very serious problems, domestic economic problems within. And he came about a year or so ago to the conclusion that Egypt could no longer afford to pay the major price for the Arabs' 30-year-old ideological position that Israel must be eliminated from the Middle East. War, and even preparations for war, had become too costly. And war and the preparations for war had always been too costly for Israel. Israel has always required peace, for peace will mean stability. Peace will mean security, that Israel is finally established on her land. Peace, the necessity, the logic of peace, had brought Sadat to Camp David. The logic of peace, the necessity of peace, had brought Menachem Begin to Camp David, and the logic and necessity of peace in the Middle East had brought the President of the United States to Camp David. But is the United States' interest to obviate the oil weapon as a possible weapon in international affairs if there is another Middle Eastern war? And is it to the interest of the United States to find a way to bridge the conflict so that she can have the secure military presence which Israel represents and the great commercial opportunity, the oil, the banking, the commerce, the building represented by Saudi Arabia and the other now rich Arab states. The nations who had come to Camp David, who worked there to produce a framework for a peace treaty, a framework for peace throughout that area, were there because they had, in a cold-eyed way, determined that they were that peace was in their national self-interest. And what is true of the motives of these nations who had come to Camp David would, I submit to you, be equally true today if one were to take a realistic evaluation of the policies of most of the nations of the world. I am comforted by the fact that war is simply too expensive today for any nation. I am comforted by the fact that the preparations for war are simply too expensive for any nation. Here we are, citizens of the richest nation on the face of the earth. And we know very well that not only does our defense budget distort the economy, contribute to inflation, but that the amount of money we spend for defense takes away from necessary monies now not available for the social good, for public welfare, for medical research, to strengthen our educational institutions, to rebuild our inner cities, for all the policies which we know we must undertake but do not undertake because the funds are being diverted to other less productive undertakings. Once upon a time, when you made war, you sent out the scum of your cities to fight as the troops, and you fought on somebody else's territory, and you brought back gold and bullion and booty. War was a profitable, an understandable, a reasonable business. Today, war is fought on the home front. The bombs drop everywhere. There are no civilians. Today, after you win a war, you must rebuild your enemy's economy. Today, just to prepare for war, you must inevitably strip your economy of the monies which are available for more humane undertakings. And so that the nations of the world slowly but surely are coming to understand that that the love of peace and the pursuit of peace is not simply the imperative of some of us who are woolly-eyed spiritualists who believe in the commands of God, Radef Shalom, Rodfei, who seek ye peace and pursue it, but that in a cold-eyed, realistic way, peace is a necessary requirement of public policy. And if the accords which were arrived at Camp David have any chance of success, of resulting in a change of attitude, and in fact resulting in peace treaties, it is because of this, the simple fact. For Israel, for Egypt, and yes, for Jordan and Syria, and certainly for the Lebanon. War is simply too expensive an undertaking. War cannot be conceived as a rational instrument for promoting public policy or for increasing the nation's well-being and resource. Coming so as close as it did to this new year, I found, and perhaps you found, that the mood of Camp David, our thoughts about what happened there, have infected, have shaped all that we feel about the new year. When he spoke to the Congress the day after the conclusion of Camp David, the president described the events of the last 30 years in the Middle East as what he called a textbook in pessimism. And the image is an apt one. When you consider four wars and endless acts of violence, the refugee camps, the refugees on both sides, the human suffering which has taken place in that part of the world. But as I thought of this image, I bethought myself that the Middle East is not the only textbook in pessimism from which we've had to read. Indeed, one could create quite a library of books detailing events which have happened in our world in recent years, which are textbooks in pessimism. There'd be a shelf dedicated to race and the relations between the races. There'd be a shelf devoted to the arms race, the needless sums plunged into weaponry, into missiles of destruction. There'd be a volume or two devoted to the greed of individuals. There'd be national volumes, thick volumes, Ireland, Cambodia, Vietnam, Korea, Bangladesh, Uganda, Rhodesia, Nicaragua, Chile. I suspect there'd even be a volume labeled Cleveland. We wake up to black headlines. We drive to work, those of us who work in the city, through a rather dismal landscape. And though I doubt that any of us are confirmed pessimists, I think that most of us do not quite recognize how much this pessimistic mood, this feeling that nothing quite works out, that our world isn't what it used to be and probably never will be again, has infected all that we think and our habits of thought and of attitude. In the weeks before Camp David, I heard no one, literally no one, saying Camp David will be a success. I heard no one suggest that Camp David might produce a framework for an Arab, for an Israeli-Egyptian peace. What I heard was, here is the President of the United States acting again on impulse. The best that President Carter can hope for is an agreement that Sadat and Begin will meet again. But literally no one suggested that what eventuated could, in fact, come about. I suggest that more than we, most of us, recognize, we have become children of dismay. We have become people who have tended to look bleakly on our world and no longer to dare to think in grand and bold terms. Where are all the grand visions today? The great causes. Obviously the needs are there. But where are the causes and where are the visions? I found the fact of Camp David's success, or seeming success, the fact that it increased, as the president said, the chance of peace. I found it a welcome reminder at the beginning of a new year that life is not doomed. Life is difficult. Life is often bruising. Life is often predictable. But we're not fated. We're not doomed. There are things that we can do. There are plans that we can undertake. We can move our world a little bit forward if we have the wisdom and if we have the courage and if we have the will. I found Camp David acting in my own mind as a case history of some of the very fundamental teachings of our faith. When God creates the world, the Bible does not praise God simply for the physicality, the immensity, the cosmos, but because what he created is good, because it is filled with promise. We have only the courage and the wisdom and the will to mine that promise and bring it forth, to tend the flame. Life is potentially good. There is promise out there. We are born human beasts. By training, we can turn ourselves and be turned by those who love us into human beings. See, I have set before you this day the blessing and the curse, life and death. Choose life. There is a weary dragging along which some people undertake between the cradle and the grave, and then there is life, vigor, purpose, commitment to causes beyond ourselves, a willingness to give of ourselves, to share life, to feel and to share feeling. There is existence and there is life. There is the dreary and the dismal, and there is the vigorous and the purposeful. Choose life. At Camp David, the three nations that were there chose life. And the choosing is never easy. We choose at a risk. Most of us never choose life because we're too timid or fearful. It's easier to hold on to what we have than to walk out into the unknown. Camp David need not have taken place. President Carter need not have encouraged Mr. Sadat and Mr. Begin to come to the United States. He had a lot to lose. His stock was low. A failure would have pushed his stock even lower and possibly would have cost him his re-election. He gambled on Camp David. He risked a great deal. And Mr. Sadat risked a great deal by coming to Camp David. He risked the anger, the renewed anger of his Arab brothers. He risked assassination, because it's a violent world in which he lives. And Mr. Begin risked not so much personally, but all Israel risked a great deal by coming to Camp David. For Israel, as a consequence of Camp David, will withdraw its soldiers from the Sinai and withdraw its soldiers and its cannon from the islands which guard the Straits of Tiran, and will remove its derricks from the oil fields and its planes from the airfields. It will withdraw into its 1967 borders. And once this withdrawal is complete, There's no returning the soldiers and the cannon, no putting, opening the tap on the oil again, short of war. And of course, there are no guarantees that Israel, that Egypt will not find some reason in the long negotiations which will eventuate to renounce the peace agreement and simply to gobble up which has been given to her and to not to make, to complete the peacemaking which is contemplated. Those who came to Camp David risked a great deal for peace. And I'm glad that they had the courage to. And they set for us an example in our private lives. For most of us are in one way or another involved in a Near Eastern situation in the context of our lives. Our children will not listen, or our parents talk too much. Our wives are determined to lead only their own lives, or our husbands are determined that our wives must lead the lives that we insist on. Our parents demand too much of our time, we complain, and we have no time, they complain for them. And most of us go on day by day in some human situation with someone close to us at a distance, angry, bitter, making snide remarks off the side or even directly to the other. There are two ways, of course, to approach these problems. We can sit in angry silence, facing each renewed contact bitterly, complaining, full of self-pity. Each day becomes more shadowed, an increasing burden. We can do something about it. We can't change the other, we can change ourselves. There's help, there are institutions, there's restraint. We can teach ourselves not to care that much. There are things that can be done if we're willing to risk the doing. Life requires risks. Every relationship which we undertake is a risk, because no relationship is totally idyllic. We give ourselves to those that we love. That's a risk. Every profession we undertake is a risk. The professions are demanding of time, of energy, of self. We risk our self-respect. We risk our energies in them. All that is worth doing requires risk. Are we willing in the new year to risk so that there can be more life, a fuller life for us during the year? And paradoxically, even as Camp David suggests that we must choose life, whatever the risk, it suggests that we must not act impulsively. Those who came to Camp David came prepared, laden with position paper, with in-depth research on all that might eventuate. Nobody spoke impulsively. When they sat down to write out the paragraphs of the framework, there were all the scenarios, the paragraphs were gone over and over again, read and reread, compared to the notes that had been brought. There were positions and fallback positions, suggestions of all kinds which had been developed by the ministries which support the chiefs of state. When we risk in life, we must be prepared. Prepared emotionally, prepared intellectually, prepared by knowing what we're doing. But many of us approach the new year impulsively. We'll make a resolution or two without really thinking about it. Or we find ourselves unhappy with a relationship in which we're involved or an employment which is ours, and we impulsively turn it over. And we think that somehow by throwing off this responsibility, we will somehow find the happiness that we seek. When we act with concern, having planned our actions, having thought them through, and then take a risk, that's the adult way. Children act impulsively. Time and again, we are childish, all of us, in our reactions. We react to the moment, and we fail to make the plans that need to be made. How many people have suddenly come to retirement, work up to the last day without thinking of the day after they receive the watch and the accolades and the emptiness that's theirs? How many people break up a marriage believing somehow that the second marriage will be better without looking at themselves and asking what it is that they bring to the marriage which allows them to hope for a successful, satisfying, fulfilling relationship? Careful planning, risk-taking, the promise that is in life. Camp David teaches many truths. And perhaps the last truth is a truth which goes to the nature of the new year. It may be a good year, it may not. There will be moments of fulfillment and moments of frustration. There will be the sunshine and the shadow. For Camp David says to each of us of the future, there are no guarantees. There are no guarantees that a peace treaty will ever be signed between Egypt and Israel, and if it is signed, there are no guarantees that the consequences of peace will in fact be effected. There are no guarantees in life for any of us. To live is to walk an uncertain way. But to walk a certain way with courage, wisely, seeking to devote ourselves to others and to causes beyond ourselves, is to know that whatever happens to us along the way, each day that we have lived has been a fulfilling one. There are empty days and there are full days. What makes the difference? What we bring to the day. The work that we do, the energies which we expose, the reactions, the feelings that we have. There's a great vision in the book of Isaiah. There were no lights, of course, in the ancient towns. It's late at night. One of the citizens of Judea is abroad, and he calls up to the guard, the sentinel, on the top of the wall, for he cannot see beyond the wall to the countryside. Shomer mami laila, shomer mami leo. Watchman, what of the night? Watchman, what of the night? The sentinel looks out towards the Judean hills, and he sees the first rays of the sun appearing over the mountaintops. He calls down to the citizen, Ata Boker, Begam Laila. The morning comes, but also the night. There is no day without its night. There is no night without its day. There is no year without its sorrow. There is no year without its joy. There are no guarantees. Only this guarantee. That if you have the courage, and the will, and the wit, and the wisdom to do more with your life than simply to drag along through the day. To commit yourself to people worth the loving. To commit yourself to causes worth the sacrifice. To commit yourself to your talents, to develop them to the full. To commit yourself in love to those who need your love. If you're willing to commit yourself in that way to each day of the new year, whatever happens, it'll be a good year. Shana Tova Tikatevu. May each of you write through your own energies, and your own plans, a good year this next year. Amen.